From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The House votes to hold former Trump advisor Steve Bannon in criminal contempt of Congress as the Supreme Court agrees to hear a quick appeal to the Texas abortion law. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnist Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. The House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot has sent a subpoena to Steve Bannon, who worked on President Trump's 2016 campaign and then briefly in the White House. Bannon has said he doesn't intend to comply with that subpoena. And so on Thursday, the House voted 229 to 202, with 9 Republicans crossing the aisle to hold Bannon in criminal contempt. That referral now goes to the Justice Department for either further action or further inaction. So, Bill, what did you make of this development?
Well, first of all, most of the time, it doesn't have the consequences that that Congress thinks it has. The goal often is to get the person to testify, right? That's supposed to be the goal. And Congress has several channels with its contempt. It can do what they've done here, make a referral to the Justice Department, hope that there's some prosecution there. It can go the civil route, which is the usual route where you sue, but that then takes years to sort out these claims. Or it can use a route that it's almost never used in about 100 years, which is to jail the person. There used to be a jail in Congress. Congress could make use of a Capitol Hill jail or something, and you hold them there until they do testify. I think what's likely to happen is they're going to go the lawsuit route. I mean, they put a lot of pressure on Merrick Garland now. Is this the kind of decision he really wants to make to prosecute a former Trump associate over a very controversial commission? So I think he's put the Justice Department in an awkward position here. And again, if Congress were really serious about it, I mean, someday I would love to see Congress use its power to jail someone until they testify. I think they should have done it in Lois Lerner's case, but they almost never do that. And so often these things are either just purely symbolic, a contempt citation against someone, or bogged down in litigation as they sort out the claims and counterclaims. Because one of the problem is with the referral is then you're inviting another a separate branch of government to make the decision to go ahead, where the jailing them yourself, that's your own powers that you have that you could use. So I expect a lot of litigation before any of this is sorted out.
Kim, what was your reaction to the contempt vote? And I guess another good question to ask up top is, do we know what information specifically the House wants to get from Bannon? He left the White House in 2017, although I guess he's continued on as an informal advisor of sorts to the president.
Well, to deal with that second question first, it's all a bit murky. The speculation or suggestion from the committee is that it believes that Bannon was in talks with Donald Trump in the lead up to or on January 6th, and they want to know what the content of those conversations were. Because this committee, and I do find it a bit alarming, it's supposed to be a fact-finding mission. There does seem to be a lot of prejudgment already, and there seems to be a clear attempt to definitely saddle Donald Trump with responsibility for January 6th. And, you know, we should all have the facts, but they seem to be driving already toward a conclusion before they've actually got that testimony or that evidence. But that's why they're asking him in. I guess my view on the fact that they immediately went to contempt is that this is in keeping with Congress, but I think in a sort of worrisome direction Congress has been going for a while. There's a certain arrogance that is increasingly attached to all of these investigations. It does. The reality is that if you look at Congress as an investigator, it increasingly has been pushing itself into all kinds of areas that in the past we would have left, for instance, to law enforcement. And it's really testing the boundaries of Congress's power to simply compel both documents and compel testimony. You know, it's interesting, at least on the document front, Constitutionally, there is no congressional right to demand documents. Just as interestingly, too, there's no constitutional right for executive privilege, which is what the executive branch often claims. And because of this unclearness in the past, there have kind of been these tussles that they usually get settled by compromise. But increasingly, and you saw this, Adam Schiff did it during his impeachment proceedings, they're doing all kinds of things to try to force and compel people to hand over stuff to them without having any litigation about what the kind of contours or the limits are of these powers. Like in Adam Schiff, for instance, did it by serving secret subpoenas to companies to get a hold of, for instance, phone records, thereby, because they were done in secret, denying the targets of those subpoenas or for information an opportunity to litigate in court whether or not Congress really has the right to it. And the Bannon subpoena raises all kinds of interesting questions here too, again, about executive privilege. He's asserting that he doesn't have to talk because he's covered by Donald Trump's executive privilege claim. If you talk to legal scholars, there's a wide range of opinions as to whether or not that's a strong case to make or a very weak case to make. I lean toward the weaker one, but it's still a question that's never been settled by courts. And you would think that Congress would at least want to answer that question before it went down the road of holding someone in contempt and serving them up for prosecution.
On the point about fact-finding and prejudging, I mean, I guess my view is that Trump is responsible for what happened on January 6th. I mean, he told people falsehoods that the election was stolen. He called them to D.C. on the day that the Electoral College votes were going to be counted. He riled them up and he urged them to march toward the Capitol. And yet, Kim, to your point, I mean, there seems to be some suggestion of organization that I don't think is clear.
It fits right. With the fact that's my point. Yes.
And in the court records of those people who are now being prosecuted for the crimes that they committed on that day, Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin said this week. He said every insurrection needs a headquarters, referring to some meeting that Steve Bannon apparently had the day previous to January 6th. To my eye, that goes a little bit beyond what we know so far. On the executive privilege point, I mean, Bill, what's your view of that? My understanding is as Kim describes, there's no real codified rules of executive privilege. It's a bit of a give and take between the branches of government and between it, that plays out in the courts, and it's based on this idea of separation of powers. The president has to be allowed to hear candid advice from people to make the decisions he needs to make as the leader of the executive branch, and he needs some confidentiality in that.
Yeah, I sympathize with that view. First of all, we have to remember that a lot of these things are not designed to be to yield a perfect outcome. A lot of this is about what you said, the back and forth. You know, Congress can hold, wants to see some documents or hear some testimony and hold someone in contempt. The White House pleads executive privilege. But many of these cases, at the end of the day, both sides have an incentive to work something out, and they do. The real purpose is not to get a court ruling to back up your claim for contempt or so forth, but ostensibly to get the information. And a lot of times it has worked out for this. I think this is such a highly charged issue. I believe we had the FBI just 2 months ago saying that they didn't find evidence that the January 6th riots were planned by, you know, right-wing groups or Trump supporters. Someone was quoted by Reuters saying 90 to 95% of these are one-off cases. I think a lot of Republicans suspect that this commission is not about finding a sober set of facts that both sides can at least agree on. This is what happens, that it's part of a larger thing to tag Republicans and Trump supporters in particular as being insurrectionists and so forth. And so they're very suspicious of the effort. Again, I think what we're likely to get is just a lot of litigation because, as you say, it hasn't been codified. The Supreme Court, in terms of contempt, did say early on that it's sort of an implied power, that, in other words, Congress would be subject to all sorts of indignities if it couldn't, enforce its will when it asks someone to testify. But again, how far that can go, what the conditions are, this is, you know, this has all been back and forth before, and it hasn't been clarified. And I think that Steve Bannon's going to take advantage of all this. I mean, it's why these cases often, when I was in the Bush administration, I left in the last year, but after that, the chief of staff and someone else were held in contempt. And it took a year or two of negotiations before they came up with an agreement of what they would speak about, what they wouldn't. And that's the way these things generally go.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. To my eye, there are a few challenges for Bannon's claim of executive privilege here. One is that he was an informal advisor to the president, not on the payroll. He left the White House in 2017. Two is that President Trump is no longer in office, and so it's not clear whether that executive privilege weakens for a former president. Three is that Congress has a legitimate interest in getting to the bottom of this physical attack, invasion, whatever you want to call it, of the legislature. And four is that this material we're talking about, whatever Bannon told Trump, doesn't relate to national security, foreign affairs, or places, subjects where state secrecy generally comes into play. But the question then, Kim, to what Bill raised at the beginning of this conversation is, how can Congress enforce that? A civil suit takes forever. Congress has the power of the purse, but that doesn't really matter to somebody who's in private life. Theoretically, Congress could send the sergeant at arms to arrest Bannon, or they have this Justice Department referral process.
First, just to go back to through some of the things you just said, though, about the case that Bannon would make here. I agree that it's very unclear, first of all, whether or not even Donald Trump has the level of executive privilege that he is claiming at the moment, because he's not in office anymore. And we recently did have a couple of Supreme Court decisions, including the Mazars case, in which Trump was included in that suit. And so there's a little bit more guidance, but it doesn't really deal with the limits of executive privilege for former presidents. And then, as you say, Bannon is more removed than even that. I would quibble a little bit with your claim that Congress has an obvious legitimate interest in this. And I actually think that is one of the things that would maybe work in Bannon's favor if there was litigation, because, you know, one of the limiting principles of Congress's ability to demand different things is that it's supposed to be tightly connected to legislative purpose. One thing that's interesting about this committee is it has yet to define what the legislative purpose of its investigation is. It seems very, very focused, again, on making the argument that somehow Donald Trump coordinated all of this. But that's a very different question from conducting an investigation, because you're trying to find out what failed among the Capitol Police that day, what security problems there were, et cetera. I haven't heard the committee focused on that at all. And that would certainly be something that would come up if there was ever litigation. But in terms of where it goes, yeah, look, in the past, as Bill very, very correctly noted, Congress doesn't have a lot of powers to do things. And it basically is at the mercy of justice departments to move this forward. But watch this space very carefully, because in the past, departments of justice have been somewhat reluctant to actually bring those cases, in part because sometimes those being held in contempt are members of its own administration. So most notably, Eric Holder, obviously was held in contempt, but was never prosecuted. Just in the Trump administration, both former Attorney General Bill Barr and White House counsel Don McGahn were held in contempt, but the Trump Department of Justice did not prosecute them. The one that I find most notable is Lois Lerner, the former IRS official who was held in contempt over testimony she gave to Congress. An Obama prosecutor declined in the end to do any prosecution. And so this puts Merrick Garland in a tough spot because it would be a little unusual. And also, like in general, departments of justices in the past tend to tread very carefully when you're dealing with political figures as well, too, understandably, because of the risk of looking like it's engaged in a politicized prosecution. So I wouldn't want to be him right now.
And it was interesting. There was a statement that Biden made on this point, and then under some pressure, it seems the White House kind of walked it back. So first, Biden was asked his message for people refusing these subpoenas. He said, "I hope that the committee goes after them and holds them accountable." Then he was asked whether those people should be prosecuted by the Justice Department, and he said, "I do, yes." And Bill, I mean, this adds to the awkwardness, I think, for Merrick Garland. On the other hand, President Biden is the head of the executive branch and responsible for what the Justice Department does, no?
Yes, I think that gets back to the real issue that's almost lost in a lot of these tussles, is prudence. You know, a lot of people say the president has no authority over the Department of Justice's decisions on prosecutions. That's not true. Constitutionally, as a full authority, you could say, "I'd like to, I think this case should be prosecuted." That's not a prudent thing to do, though, because that then suggests that political considerations are dictating what you do. So that's why we have this this sort of tradition where attorneys general try to maintain independence from the politics of the White House in these decisions. But and we saw it with Biden, because first he suggested it and it's within his powers, and then he backtracked because he realized this isn't a good thing. Again, I think the real consequence of this, that all the murk and the lack of clarity, we're not going to get, I think, a decision that clarifies once and for all the limits on executive privilege or contempt by Congress. They may say in this case, Mr. Bannon cannot cite it as a defense. I mean, that's possible, but we're not likely to get that conclusion because a lot of this, again, goes back and forth to the give and take. And the elephant in the room here is, again, a lot of Republicans believe that the reason for this urgency is they want to get, have Steve Bannon as a notch on their gun because of the January 6th riots, in time for the midterm elections, where I think they're just going to again talk about Trump as the threat to the American people and democracy. So a lot of people, again, that's one of the reasons people fear that this kind of prosecution would be very politicized, and it has a potential for backfiring. Again, the least thing is the most probable. This is going to go back and forth. The examples Kim cited, one reason that you have a lot of contentious things back and forth in the Department of Justice usually declining to prosecute these things is that the Chamber of Commerce that has held someone in contempt is of a different party from the person or official held in contempt. In this case, you have a Democratic House doing it to Bannon, who is a member of the other political party, but the Department of Justice is a Democratic Department of Justice here. So I would say it's more likely, but it's still kind of a potential tar baby for Merrick Garland.
Finally, on Friday, the Supreme Court refused to, again, immediately block the Texas abortion law that generally bans abortions after about 6 weeks, but it agreed to hear oral arguments on a narrow question on November 1st, which, Kim, is lightning fast for the Supreme Court. So how do you read this order?
Well, this is the Supreme Court saying, as it had already promised it would when it was asked to intervene here a while ago. The minute that the Texas law was passed, there was immediately an appeal to the court to intervene and put a stay on it and hear it. because of the nature of this Texas law, which is unusual and in my mind problematic, but it essentially allows private parties to litigate to stop abortions. The Supreme Court rightly noted that it didn't really have any ability to engage in this law until someone had actually brought such an action. Now, that has obviously happened, and there's litigation. And so the court, in keeping, it did say that this was obviously a big deal, and that when someone presented it with an actual case, it would move. And this is what the court is doing. It is lightning fast, which probably reflects the sort of big headline nature of the case. Interestingly, the order was extremely brief, and one of the reasons it was incredibly it caused a bit of a stir is that the court had been asked not only to do this in an expedited fashion, but to stay the law until it had actually until it could be heard in front of the court. It declined to do that. It said that the law would remain in practice until it heard this expedited hearing. This draw a very strong rebuke, notably though only from one member of the court, Justice Sotomayor, who wrote a long dissent saying, quote, "Because every day the court fails to grant relief is devastating, both for individual women and for our constitutional system as a whole. I dissent from the court's refusal to stay administratively the lower court's order." So at least one justice not happy that the court didn't go farther, but it certainly is showing itself to be moving quickly on this issue.
And also notable is that there's another abortion case already on the Supreme Court's docket. That one is supposed to be heard on December 1st. That's involving a Mississippi law, which generally bans abortions at about 15 weeks of pregnancy. So, Bill, do you see any connection between these two? Does the hearing of this Texas case on November 1st affect the positioning of the Mississippi case that the Supreme Court is going to hear a month later?
Well, I could be wrong, but it strikes me that the court's attention to the Texas law, quick attention and so forth, is designed to remove the Texas law as an issue before they get down to debating the Dobbs case, the case that you mentioned that is takes direct aim at Roe. I think that right now, the way I read it is that if Roe is overturned in any significant way, in other words, if it opens the door to states putting bans on abortion before viability, if those bans are upheld, I think the Texas law really becomes moot in many ways and doesn't really matter. So I think it's only really important to the fate of abortion if Roe and Casey, more to the point, are upheld by the Supreme Court. If they're not upheld, I think we'll see a lot more straightforward restrictions than the kind of Rube Goldberg restriction we have here in Texas, which, as other groups realize, could be used in a lot of other cases to empower people to litigate things to death and so forth. I don't think that's really the way we want to organize society.
And to that point, there was an interesting brief, friend of the court brief, filed in the Texas case this week by the Firearms Policy Coalition. And what are they doing filing a brief in a Supreme Court case about abortion? Well, I'll just read a line of it. It says, FPC is interested in this case because the approach used by Texas to avoid pre-enforcement review of its restriction on abortion and its delegation of enforcement to private litigants could just as easily be used by other states to restrict First and Second Amendment rights, or indeed virtually any settled or debated constitutional right. And I think we talked about that on a previous program. You can imagine a state passing a law saying certain firearms are not allowed anymore, and the state is not empowered to enforce it. So you can't sue before the law is enforced because there's no one that you can sue, but private parties can bring these lawsuits for $10,000 or whatever the case may be. So it's a fascinating mixture of players here as this uniquely structured law gets litigated. And Kim, we'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah, and good for them for raising it. We raised that issue that Texas, you know, was kind of being too cute by half in putting forward this particular form of a law because of the potentiality for it to be used against conservative causes. And I think the Firearms Policy Coalition very ably described what that risk is. And it's just in general, I guess, as a last word, it's something that both sides ought to be more aware of. We're in this era of politics where people increasingly engaging in very dramatic and sort of standard and norm breaking activity, which can come back to haunt you. You know, a good example, you know, you had Donald Trump declare the border a national emergency on the grounds that it would give him far more powers to approach that. But you now hear Democrats urging Joe Biden that if he can't get all of his climate provisions through reconciliation, he should declare climate a national emergency, which would give him more powers to deal with it. We all need to be stepping back and thinking a little bit more about the importance and the contours of existing laws and rules.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.